Hello, and welcome to another podcast of U.S. History Repeated with Jimmy and Gene. This is Jimmy LaSalle. In this episode, Gene Ann interviews Angela Sutton, an interpretive ranger from Tule Lake, to discuss life at the Japanese internment camps. I am going to turn it right over to Jeannie. Jeannie, take it away.
Today, we're joined by Angela Sutton, an interpretive ranger at Tule Lake National Monument in California. Angela, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
In the aftermath of the attack on Pearl Harbor, the response that the government takes is issuing what becomes known as Executive Order 9066. And what this mandates is all persons of Japanese ancestry, whether they are citizen or non-citizen, so if you are 1/16th Japanese, this pertained to you, they needed to be removed from the western coast of the United States and had to sell their belongings, take only what they could carry. And they were brought to first assembly centers and, of course, then these camps. Can you talk a little bit about Tule Lake?
So Tule Lake was one of several locations that was picked. When you actually dig into the history, you can find that prior to the start of World War II, the government had already started sending up private investigators to search and check on kind of the Japanese American population on the West Coast before the executive order even needed to occur. They were picking locations where if they did choose to do a forced removal, where they would be. And there was about 300 locations picked across the United States. And then they narrowed it down to the 10, and Tule Lake was one of those final 10. And a couple key decision factors that had to be in place for each of those locations is it needed to be federally managed property. Tule Lake was a large lake that the Bureau of Reclamation began draining in the early 1900s. And the section where the camp falls on had been drained maybe less than 20 years prior to the start of World War II. It needed to also be isolated. Our nearest community from where the camp was at the time was just over 10 miles away and had a population of only about 1,000. The next nearest town was over an hour away. And then it needed to be fertile. Being on a lake bed, this was very, very fertile ground, and therefore the camp could be fairly self-sufficient. And they needed transportation. So the highway and the railroad had already been put into place to get goods into the other communities on the north and the south section of the camp. And they were able to route local travel away from the highway. We have a section in our baselands referred to as the Old Alturas Highway. And it was what was used during World War II for anyone who was north of the camp wanting to travel south. They routed them over kind of further north and over to the east, and then brought them back down south of the camp so they couldn't even drive along the highway that ran in front of the facility. Tule Lake met all those major requirements. There had been some hope that once the camps were established, the Japanese Americans who were being held in there could then work for the local communities, and were a very big farming community, so they thought they would be able to work for the local farmers. Unfortunately, at Tule Lake, that never occurred for other reasons that we'll get into.
What was the purpose of not even wanting people to be able to drive past the camps themselves?
I'm not 100% on the full purpose other than just not letting the public know. I had a local gentleman who was too young to join the war effort. He was about 16 when World War II kicked off, and so he wasn't able to join. So he stayed local and was working on his family's farm. And he got curious, as a 15, 16-year-old would do. And him and his buddy got on horseback, and they attempted to ride towards the camp, trying at nighttime, hoping they could peek in the fence and see what was going on with this big secret facility that no one's allowed to. He said they got about a half a mile to a mile away from the camp, and they were stopped by army officers in a jeep and were told very clearly to turn around and go home, or he would be taking them home and explaining to their parents what they were doing. The government wanted to be able to really control the narrative, and allowing any access into the camp or near the camp created that window of opportunity for others to see something else than what was being pushed out with what the War Location Authority was putting out in video and audio recordings and newspapers. If you're able to drive by and you can suddenly see the guard towers or the jail being built or the stockade being built, and none of that's being publicized, and we're being told as a country this is to protect the persons of Japanese ancestry, but yet the barbed wire is pointed in and not out, and the guns are pointed in and not out. If you can drive by and see it, it doesn't match the narrative. So as a way to control that narrative even more.
Yes, and I think it's also important to talk about the terms that were used at the time and the evolution of the terms that are often used today to describe same series of events. So if you look at, the war propaganda reels of the time, you'll see things like wartime communities or relocation centers, or you'll hear the term Japanese internment used, where these are not terms that are used today to describe these facilities. You're using terms like concentration camps. You're using terms like incarceration. You're using terms like detainees. And so it's very important to understand why those terms were used in the 1940s and why we need to be very careful to use the proper terms today to describe what happened.
Yeah, the government was very specific in the terms that it's used. It helped to create that narrative to make it appear that there was no wrongdoing on the government side. And even today, the other National Park Service site that I work at deals with wildfires, and we've been evacuated twice from that park because of wildfires. And so, especially here in California, that's a pretty becoming more and more of a common thing. And so you hear that term evacuation, and it's immediately for your safety. And that was the same thought process in the 40s when they said we're evacuating these people in 42 is for their safety. Even persons of Japanese ancestry, some of the younger kids and stuff, thought this was for their safety until they got to camp. And then again, the guns are pointed in, the barbed wire is pointed in, and they're realizing, no, this wasn't for their safety. It was possibly for everyone else, but they hadn't done anything. And so it continued to build that narrative. And as we've dug and learned the terms, because even Roosevelt during World War II referred to these camps as concentration camps. He said it a few different times. But then, as we learned about what was happening in Germany, those camps needed a name. And it was the same thing there. Didn't want to name it for what it really was. So, what's the leaser, almost more friendly sounding term that could be used? So, we labeled the camps in Germany concentration camps. Well, these aren't as bad as what happened in Germany. So, what do we label them? That's then that next lower equivalent. And so they stuck with, war relocation centers or internment camps. One of the really big reasons we don't use the term internment camp here at Tule Lake is when you look at the legal definition of it refers to a place where non-US citizens are held. Out of all 10 camps, over two-thirds of their population were US-born citizens. So, by using that term, we're inadvertently stripping two-thirds of their citizenship. Also, we have other camps that were managed by the Department of Justice that were true internment camps by definition. These were holding persons of Japanese, German, and Italian ancestry who were not US citizens. And so, to try to not create confusion between the two, because they're very, very differently run, the Department of Justice facility camps were run similar to Geneva Convention rules versus Tule Lake and Manzanar, and our sites did not follow Geneva Convention rules. And in some cases, they were worse off than the Department of Justice actual internment camps, just because there wasn't that hierarching level of this is how you will treat the individuals that you're taking care of. That wasn't pushed out to all the camps.
Yes. One of the things I want to talk about is how were the camps built? What was the design? Why were they designed that way?
You can really see the military mindset behind them. It's designed without the thought process, the families, or anything else. It was done by military, and it was done very, very quickly. One of the gentlemen who was of Japanese ancestry who was held here at Tule Lake that I got to know over the years, once he got here, he got onto one of the work crews and helped finish building barracks. And he said they were putting barracks up in under an hour. They were not meant to last. They were just meant to create a shelter as fast as possible. They were using green wood. So as it dried, it created the gaps. And that's one of the reasons the barracks got wrapped in tar paper, because it was then the only barrier between them and the elements was that thin layer of tar paper, wherever those gaps were. So they were put up. They're very basic A-frame buildings. They slowly added partitions. But even the partitions that they added did not go all the way to the ceiling. So when you were in They referred to them as an apartment, but basically it was a 20 by 20 room for your entire family. And when you were in that room, you could stand on your dresser and look into someone else's room. A whole nother family's existence was right there for you to see if you wanted to. We've seen the same thing with the showers and the restrooms. There wasn't partition between stalls. There wasn't partitions between shower heads. It was just what you would see if you walked into a military facility. And the same plans were used at all 10 locations. They alter a little bit, those little tweaks. Like Manzanar had fewer toilets in their individual bathrooms versus Tule did, but we had a bigger population, so it made sense that we would have more bathroom spots. And then, so there's little tweaks like that, but for the most part, it's the same set of blueprints, copied and pasted 10 times over.
I mean, I think it's important to kind of put yourself in the mindset of in maybe a week and a half's time, you're told you need to pack up, sell your belongings of whatever you could, take what you could carry. You're brought to an assembly center. You stay there for a while. In many cases, those assembly centers were places where animals were held. You know, they're racetracks. They're not fit for human beings to be living there, right?
Yeah, so with the signing of the executive order in February, by March, individuals were seeing notices being put around their communities with the all persons of Japanese ancestry right across the top, their report date, and when they were leaving, usually only giving them on average a week. Some got a little bit more, some even only got a few days to try to get all of their affairs in order, pack up their lives, their businesses, having absolutely no idea where they're going. How long they're going to be gone for, just knowing that they could literally bring what they could carry, and that was it. And from there, then yeah, you're into one of the, there was what they technically kind of was 15 assembly centers and two reception centers, but all of these were usually fairgrounds, racetracks, or the case of like Manzanar started out as a reception center and then was converted as to one of the main. People were living in horse stalls and sleeping on straw mattresses. And they could be there from a few weeks to 3 months in those conditions in early spring, all along the West Coast where it's still cold and it's still freezing and it's muddy and it's gross. You're very unsanitary. People did everything they could to be as clean and sanitary as they could in those conditions, but it was just not designed really for anybody's benefit. Like it was just, where's the quickest place we can shove 120,000 plus people?
When people arrived at Tule Lake, aside from, you know, the conditions you described in that 20 by, you know, that 20 by 20 room, the partitions didn't go all the way up to the ceiling. A lot of the primary sources of diary entries or interviews of individuals who were detained at these camps, they talk about the lack of privacy. They talk about the constant waiting on lines, whether it's for mealtime, whether it is to use the bathroom or to take a shower or to do laundry. It's this constant waiting online. How, you know, what were the living conditions like on a day-to-day basis for people there?
Yeah, so when Tule Lake was first built in 42, it was designed to house 12,000 individuals, and it had over 15,000 individuals being held there. When they expanded the camp starting in 1943, they were expanding it to hold the 15,000, and the population was then increased to over 18,000. So here, people were constantly overcrowded. In those 20 by 20 rooms, it was nothing to have 8 people in that size space with one heater. Many would get very creative and figure out ways to stack their cots and turn their cots into bunk beds just to provide any additional space that they could to move around in. Folks were giving up their sheets and their bedding to provide themselves privacy by hanging the sheets and blankets up between where, you know, mom and dad slept versus where the kids slept. And we also kind of commonly think of it just being, you know, families, but many times your family wasn't big enough to justify having your own 20 by 20 space. And so if you were a young couple and it's just the two of you could be put into one of those 20 by 20 rooms with two or three other couples or a whole nother family that you don't even know. And so now you're in this 20 by 20 room with, someone else's parents and their children, and you're a brand new young couple, trying to create that little bit of privacy within there. And since it wasn't designed for the amount of people, that's where the lines come into place. Going into the mess hall, the average block at Tule Lake had about 325-ish people in it. The mess halls could only accommodate about half of that at any given point. So every meal was being served twice, and you were in line waiting to see if you were going to get the first wave of the meal or the second wave as everyone floated out. Restrooms, the same thing. We've got a couple of the latrines that are on private property we've gone out and looked at, and there's 14 stations for commodes for 325 people. So 14 for women and then 14 for men, but still that's 28 for over 300 people. There's always going to be a line. Same thing with the showers. It was just never designed to hold the amount of people that was placed here. And so we just, it never got better until you start to see the very end when people are leaving and it's closing. And then people then make comments about, we didn't have to wait in line because there was no one here. But otherwise, it was just this long process. There was one gentleman who I met, and he has very limited memories because he was pretty young. But he remembers his mom's frustration trying to potty train him in camp because you can't run your toddler off to the bathroom the moment they need to go, like you do when you normally potty train. So she had to get creative, and she kept a bucket, and then she would have to stand in line with that bucket to then go and dump after he had used it. And so, like, that was such a semi-traumatic experience of experiencing it as himself and then her frustration with it, that still stuck with him as an adult all these years later, when most of the rest of us don't remember anything about potty training. But something as simple as that was so traumatic that here we are 80 years later, and I ask him, what does he remember? And that is the thing that sticks out in his mind.
That's his memory. When in 1943, detainees in all camps are given essentially a loyalty questionnaire. And there were two questions in particular that caused some confusion. One question asked whether or not they would willingly enlist in the military. Another question asked if, they would defend the United States, if, renounce their citizenship. How did that questionnaire in 1943 change Tule Lake?
It changed it dramatically, way more than any of the other nine centers. So the two questions, 27 and 28. 27 ask if you will if you will serve in the U.S. Armed Forces wherever so ordered in combat duty. That one was rewritten for women because women could not serve in combat duty to would they serve in the American Red Cross unit if found eligible. And then question 28 had kind of three parts in one. It was, will you swear unqualified allegiance to United States of America and faithfully defend the U.S. against any and all foreign or domestic attack? And forswear any form of allegiance to the Japanese Emperor or any other government, organization, or power. When these questions were first written, they weren't designed to be given to all persons over the age of 17 in camp. It was designed to be given to Nisei, so that second generation Japanese American to be in the United States. So they were citizens by birth. It was to be given to Nisei men 17 to early 30s to enlist them into military service. The War Relocation Authority made the decision to use that questionnaire and give it to everyone over 17. So now you're giving it to individuals who are not US citizens because they legally could not become citizens due to laws that were passed years and years before World War II. And you're also giving it to elderly and women. Tule Lake, the questions were never rewritten to take that into account. We see it at Manzanar. They did do a rewrite for Ise, but that didn't occur here at Tule Lake. And so now you're asking individuals who legally cannot become a citizen to forswear the only allegiance and citizenship that they have, which in a way makes them a nationless person. What I've heard over and over from survivors at Tule Lake was that the administration here did not care about them. And so they didn't hold as detailed a block meetings as others got, explaining, well, You're not actually giving up your citizen. You're just confirming, that you're loyal to the US. Those kind of conversations didn't happen. And the first 100 or so men who refused to answer the questionnaire, strictly because they had questions and they wanted them answered, instead of meeting and answering those questions, they arrested them. And they sent half to the Klamath County Jail, which is an hour north of here, and the other half to the Alturas County Jail, which is an hour south of here. And if it wasn't for a Klamath County sheriff and judge getting together and digging into why these men were now put into their custody, they could have stayed there even longer. But these two, the sheriff looked into their charges because the camp officials didn't really give them much to go off of and realized there's actually no legal requirement to answer this questionnaire. So them refusing to answer it was not illegal. And he went to the judge and says, I don't feel comfortable, holding these people who've committed absolutely no crime. And the judge agreed and said, we want them out of here. We're not going to be part of this. And they told the camp officials, you need to come get them. And they called Alturas and gave them the heads up. And so Alturas said the same thing, you need to come get them. But they didn't want these men to come back to camp because now they knew there was truly no punishment for refusing to answer. So they use a different location and hold the men 15 miles away in what was used to be an old Civilian Conservation Corps camp, and it turned into an isolation center. As those men are being held over there, they're still pushing this questionnaire on everyone else, telling them they have to answer, they have to answer. If you did not answer yes to both of those questions, you were then classified as being disloyal to the United States. So if you said yes, you would serve, or no, you would not serve, but yes, you would swear allegiance, you were still considered disloyal. If you put yes, I will swear allegiance if I can become a US citizen, it was still considered a no and disloyal. And so at that time, like I said, Two Lakes population was about 15,000. About two-thirds of that was old enough to be required to answer the questionnaire. Of that, almost 42% was classified as disloyal. In comparison, at the other nine facilities, you have between 3 and 5% of their populations being classified as disloyal. Because Tule Lake has the largest percentage of these quote-unquote disloyals, it is decided it will become a maximum security segregation center, and anyone who refused to answer, said no, or gave a qualified, so yes, if answer, would then be sent to Tule Lake. Those who said yes, were given the option to leave Tule Lake. They weren't free. They could go to one of the other nine camps, or they could choose to stay here. Many did choose to leave, but actually quite a few chose not to, because by this point, it's only been a year. They've been forced out of their homes, forced into horse stalls, forced here to camp, and they're finally starting to settle. And now it's, do you want to pack up and move
Go
again?
someplace else.
Yeah. Not having any idea if you're going to be able to get a job in camp, going to be accepted when you get to the other facility, if the conditions are going to be harsher, the weather's going to be worse, because you're not getting to pick which of the nine you're going to, you're just going to get sent to one of them. And sometimes we see families have the biggest split due to this questionnaire, where the Issei parents, that first generation who came from Japan, who can't become citizens, they want to say yes. And many of them did, partly out of fear of, if we say no, what's going to happen? Are we instantly going to be sent to Japan and they don't want to go back to Japan or what? And we see their Nisei children who are citizens by birth, who know their constitutional rights, know how much has been violated, and out of protest, they're saying no. And now the parents have to make a decision of do they stay in Tule Lake or in whatever camp they're at, because they could have been at Heart Mountain. And now that child that, is 18 being and says no is going to be forced to leave. Do they stay with that child and come to Tule Lake with them or stay in Tule Lake with them? Or does the family split? And we've seen both cases. I got the amazing honor to spend some time with a family who went through that split. Their father had passed about a week before the attack on Pearl Harbor. The children ranged from 19 to, I don't even think the youngest was a year old, or maybe a year old at the most. So pretty big age gaps. And so when everything took place, the oldest son stepped up, kind of took the head of the household role, got him registered, got him to camp. They get to camp and he says no out of protest. His next younger brother is 17. He gets to answer the questionnaire however he wants. And he says yes. He wants to do everything he can to show his loyalty to this country. He wants to serve. And now their mom has to make a really hard decision of how does she answer, because her answer affects all the other children under 17. If she says yes, she'll get to stay at the camp they were at before they got here or got to Tule Lake, but she's going to lose her oldest son, and her second oldest son's going to go off into the war, and her third or oldest is 12. So not necessarily old enough to really step up and help her a lot. So she decides to say no, so she can stay with the oldest son. Those two brothers, their decisions and their disagreement on how to answer that question completely split them apart for the rest of their lives. I had the honor of meeting with their siblings, younger siblings, and their children, and their children didn't realize it until we were all sitting there talking and really kind of airing out the family history that they were never invited to each other's birthday parties. And the only time they saw that uncle and his family was at their grandma's. She insisted everyone came to her house for Christmas. That, this government-imposed questionnaire had impacted this family going into three generations without them even realizing it, just because the brothers so vehemently disagreed on this. And it wasn't something they should have even had to go through. And then, the second younger brother, had mixed feelings about mom, of she sided with the older brother by saying no. Well, no, she wasn't siding with him. She needed that support. She had seven other kids under the age of 12 to take care of. She needed assistance, and the only way she could guarantee it was to say no. And so her and all the younger siblings and the oldest brother all get sent here to Tule Lake, and the second youngest, he goes off. He serves in the 442nd, which we know to this day is still the most highly decorated unit in military history. I mean, their accolades are amazing. And she's very proud of both sons for their decisions, but she had to make the worst case scenario decision for everyone under that age. And so the question, we really see it tear a lot of families apart. I've met other people who suspect that their parents changed their answers, that they wanted to answer yes and their parents wanted to answer no, and they handed over their form to their parents to turn in for them, and they were all sent here to Tule Lake. And one gentleman, he never requested his file, and I truly believe it's because he didn't want to know that his dad had changed his answers. Because anytime I asked him, he told me over and over, he goes, "I answered yes. I don't know why I was sent here." And I think it's because he knew his dad changed and he did not want to know that. But that was the only way they could keep the family together.
The only way they could stay together. I don't think people truly understand the chain of events. I think it's something that they know that happened. Pearl Harbor happened. Japanese, people of Japanese ancestry were forced into these camps, but they don't understand what happened to people on a very personal level after that, and what it took once the war was over to build their lives back up. If you look at things like the Renunciation Act of 1944, where people were given the opportunity to renounce their American citizenship, and many people did out of anger, out of protest. This number is over 5,000. And after the war in 47, President Truman gives amnesty to those individuals where they could get their citizenship back, but it's not, widely publicized. Many people spent the rest of their lives never knowing that they had gotten that citizenship back.
And it was a really hard fight. It took a gentleman by the name of Wayne Collins. He was a lawyer out of the San Francisco Bay Area. When you look at that 5,000 plus plus number of those that renounced and you look into it, it's mostly people at Tule Lake. They were put here. This converts to that segregation center. We go from a couple hundred, like 100 to 200 military personnel who are only ever supposed to be on the exterior of the fence, to a full battalion, 1,200 military personnel being brought in, army tanks and jeeps being brought in. The camp goes under martial law on at least two occasions. The military, you know, fully takes control, and that doesn't happen anywhere else.
Okay, we are going to pause here and pick this up with part two of our interview with Angela Sutton, which will be the third and final of our coverage on Japanese internment. So thank you for listening to U.S. History Repeated with Jimmy and Gene. Tell your friends about our podcast and where you learn all this great stuff about U.S. history. Follow us on social media and get onto our email list to learn about special events. They're coming up again. There's always more to learn. Talk to you soon.